Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 187. It's 1851. Time to take stock of what's going on across Southern Africa, which, as you know, was in the throes of the Eighth Frontier War, a significant war. After that, we will return to Thomas Stubbs, who had turned himself into a useful night raider and was about to show the British how to fight in the Albany thickets. To the north, in the mountains of the Basutu people, King Moshoeshoe I was not idle in early 1851, and his patience with his own kith and kin, as well as with the Boers and the British, had worn out. When word of Mlanjeni the prophet reached the Basutu, and how his new message of salvation through a mixture of Christianity and Amakhosa religion had resonated with so many, Moshoeshoe kept a clear head. He had allowed the French missionaries, and Kasali in particular, to operate within his kingdom and trusted the men in black. But now the exuberant revival of traditional customs and rituals and warfare began to sweep through Lesotho, a millenarian movement. Mlanjeni's reputation caused a relapse amongst the Basutu converts, led by a local diviner called Mantsopa, who began to build a formidable reputation as a soothsayer. She could predict victories in war, it was said, and in 1850 and 1851 the revivalist movement grew more powerful. Moshoeshoe was always cautious when it came to religion, as you'll hear when we return over the coming episodes. In 1851, the millennial message of return to the old ways and customs, obey the ancestors, sacrifice the light-coloured and yellow cattle. All these things meant true believers would be insulated from the power of bullets and the immunity would drive all the whites beyond the seas. This was also Mantsopa's basic message. She was not an opportunist. Mantsopa was very much a woman of her time. I mentioned last episode how these anti-colonial movements were breaking out across the globe, and the Basutu soothsayer was also responding to the immediate threat posed by invaders, mainly from Europe. The people throughout Lesotho at the time greeted each other with the words, "Molojini is king! Mlanjeni is king!" when they heard of the Amakhosa victories in the Eastern Cape. Moshoeshoe took note of this reaction and how the racial and political message was deeply felt by his people. And yet, he continued to attend French missionary Kasali's church services out of good faith and ensured that the missionaries were well protected. He was reinforcing to all that he was a man of his word. But behind the scenes, he was having second thoughts about their presence. He used the missionaries as scribes and interpreters and even diplomatic negotiators. But over time, his initial hope that they would prove to be the vanguard of an honourable future people was to be dashed. When the first missionaries arrived, and the first Boers, he let himself be fooled, at least. That was what he said to missionary Abuse in 1852. Moshoeshoe said he had hoped that white people were different from black people, but now he said he knew everyone was the same. Everyone trampled on the rights of others. Moshoeshoe was disillusioned. "You are civilized," he said to Abuse. "You do not steal cattle, it is true, but you steal entire countries." Abuse wrote this down furiously in April 1852. "And if you could, you would send our cattle to pasture in the clouds." That was because the missionaries and the authorities came to realize that the value of the herd was intrinsically part of the world view of most people of Southern Africa, including the Boers. Moshoeshoe rejected the idea of being converted. Mantsopa seemed to offer a reasonable alternative to the missionaries' ways. The Basutu chief reconvened initiation schools, began to perform all traditional sacrifices and purifications, and consulted Mantsopa before he did anything. Once she gave her blessing, Moshoeshoe sent messengers all the way down to the Amatolas to greet Mlanjeni, the Amakhosa prophet. And yet, folks, Moshoeshoe, like Makoma and Sandile, were not throwing everything into this new millenarian prophet-driven ideology. Oh no, Moshoeshoe I had suffered too much at the hands of other Africans and had gained many benefits from the missionaries. He was in a quandary, a contradiction. This is the really incredible thing. Whereas most others around him were quite ready to go on some terminal quest to kill all the invaders, he was first and foremost a realist. This all began to come to a head as the Eighth Frontier War exploded and the British officials in the Orange River sovereignty demanded restitution for cattle raiding at the same time. Major Henry Warden to be more specific, in charge at the Orange River Sovereignty HQ, Bloemfontein. In February 1851, a section of the Amantembu, who had risen up against the British, began raiding cattle in the southeast of the Free State. The Boers complained. More importantly, they were joined by Basutu chief and Moshoeshoe's brother Pocholi, who took particular aim at the Amamfengu. That was after his land was included by Sir Harry Smith when the governor declared the Orange River sovereignty in 1848. Things were even more confusing in the north of Moshoeshoe's territory, the Upper Caledon Valley. Moshoeshoe's subject Mosemi had clung onto the area inside territory that Major Warden had allocated for Maroka, Moshoeshoe's Basutu opponent. Remember, at this time Moshoeshoe was not thought of as in command of all Basutu. He was still building his kingdom, and Maroka was very much his arch-enemy. And Mosemi and his ally Moletsane were fending off more than just the seizure of their land. They were being raided by the Batlokwa, the Kora, and the Rolong. It was a wild time in that wondrous place called the Caledon Valley, folks. In effect, the British had interposed themselves between all of these interlopers, interfering, if you like, and trying to play referee in a form of conflict that was chaos theory epitomized. Warden was indulging in the hopeless task of trying to find blame and attempting to force compensation for loss when pretty much everyone was busy raiding and counter-raiding. By the time of the Eighth Frontier War, the British and Major Warden specifically had developed the storyline that Maroka was the good Basutu and Moshoeshoe the bad. Virtually at the very moment that Imlanjeni and Makoma and Sandile launched their attacks on the British along the Kaiskama River and in the Tumi Valley, Warden confronted Moshoeshoe about cattle going missing in the Orange River sovereignty. Responding passively at first, Moshoeshoe had embarked on a simple philosophy years before when it came to these invaders, the Boers, the Kora, the Bastards, the Rolong, now the British. Because his biggest threats were local Basutu competitors and the AmaZulu, as well as the Amandebele of Mzilikazi, he was prepared to seek out new allies from beyond the mountains when they arrived. At the same time, and if he'd had a Google spreadsheet, he was always in the black. He made sure that he'd be in credit whatever happened. He was collecting villages and herds as he went, which led to increased power amongst his people. If he handed back raided cattle to the Boers or the Griqua, he'd always keep a few as a form of interest. He stayed in the positive, and his people knew it. So what of the Eighth Frontier War? What of its importance to the Basutu? You'd think that the British officials, like Major Warden, would calm down. We don't want a war on numerous fronts now, do we? Instead of taking a rain check, Warden persisted with his aggressive policy against Moshoeshoe. Then in early 1851, Warden made his move. At first glance, his initial military foray would make some sense. South from Bloemfontein towards the Amamtembu. This was on the border between Basutu country and British Kaferia. The Amamfengu were fighting with the British, but by now the Trek Boers and Dutch farmers had experienced one raid too many and had also joined the British in the war against Sandile and the Amamtembu down in the Amatolas. In the minds of officials like Warden, a preemptive strike was required because the Amamtembu also abutted his districts across the Orange River. Local officials wanted Warden to attack Morosi immediately before Moshoeshoe rose up against the British. The Basutu chief had remained out of the fray, although he was making noises about his own prophet Mantsopa. And as he heard, and the British heard, he had sent messages to Umlanjeni, the Maxhosa prophet. Ironically, Moshoeshoe was not planning action of any kind, at least at this point. He was a realist, inclined to monitor and collect information, wait and see. By mid-February, Warden had heard enough reports about raiding going on and decided to move. His actions were going to reverberate all the way back to Colonial Secretary Earl Grey in England. The British press had switched from lauding Governor Harry Smith to lambasting him. Major Warden, like Smith's other minion, Henry Somerset, was caught like a rabbit in a political headlight. When the time comes, the hero ignites, or when the moment calls, no one answers, to mix a few metaphors. Southeast of Bloemfontein, there's a large rambling mountain full of caves. The Boers called this area Hangklip or Genadeberg and was close to where the Amatembu were based. I tracked down the British formal military report on what happened. I'll mix that up with Basutu oral tradition and Amatembu narratives just so that we're covering this in an accurate manner. Major Warden had 2 6-pounder guns under Lieutenant Singer's command and was accompanied by a Major Donovan. They led a detachment of 45th Regiment and a troop of the Cape Mounted Rifles, bolstered by a Boer commando and Khoi Khoi levies. And on the 14th of February, this mobile force managed to clear the caves of Amamtembu after a day's fighting. One private of the 45th was killed, along with 4 of the Khoi Khoi levies, and 21 Amamtembu warriors died. The British then camped nearby. On the 15th, Warden received word from British officials inside the Cape Colony who asked him to cross the Orange River into the colony itself to help troops base their Fort Morosi, who was Mashweshwe's ally. Without waiting for permission, Warden plunged across the river, something which his commander Harry Smith was to criticise later as an unwarranted assumption of responsibility. Warden had little other option, though. Had he waited for permission, it would have been too late. Major Donovan of the 45th led this operation. Warden was apparently merely alongside as a spectator, so they forded the Orange on the 22nd of February and then camped at Dulcie's Neck, about 24 kilometres from the Basutoland border and about 28 kilometres from Morosi's village. Magistrate Cole, the local British official, was joined by 80 Boers on commando and advanced over the open country beyond Dulcie's Neck, crossed the border, whereupon they were suddenly attacked by Morosi's men. The Basutu soldiers were mounted and many were armed with muskets. 9 men were lost in that sharp encounter and everyone retreated towards Dulcie's Neck. The cannon base there then opened fire, killing a dozen Basutu warriors who were charging towards the encampment. On the 27th of February, Donovan retired to the mission station of Bensonville and Warden and the Sovereignty Irregulars recrossed the Orange, licking their wounds. Meanwhile, Mashweshwe had sent some reinforcements of his own to Morosi, who tracked down the right bank of the Orange, crossed behind the Amamfungu villages there, and attacked the British on the 28th of March. But as with other engagements in southern Africa, the Basutu had miscalculated the power of an organised army in a well-defended position. The Cape Mounted Rifles, about 140 Amamfungu warriors, and the British, armed with their cannon, surprised Morosi. He was forced to retreat, and 200 Basutu warriors were killed in this exchange. So I mention all of these machinations for a few reasons. Firstly, the conflict in southern Africa has never been localized. Waves of socio-political effect lap outwards from the center of the violence, or the war, or the clash, and these waves sometimes crash on distant landscapes. Secondly, when an empire is stressed financially, bureaucrats and technocrats fall foul of political tendencies. Earl Grey was part of both bureaucratic and political pressure zones. As these murmurings in the press grew to a hubbub, then a hullabaloo, the government under which he worked, Russell's administration, was going to fall apart. All because of men like Smith and Warden, Makoma, Mlanjeni, Mashweshwe. Not to mention the women like Mantsoba, the soothsayer. And now it's time to return to that story I mentioned earlier of Thomas Stubbs. His part in this epic drama is seemingly insignificant, and yet it is more important at second glance. What, would you say, could really be important about a small-scale import-export trading rebel who could sew saddles from Albany? A man whose father Henry made money trading illegally with Amaxhosa. As I mentioned in passing last episode, in some ways, Stubbs set off a series of what became known as special force tactics. He wasn't alone in this period. The British Army was coming up regularly against unconventional soldiers, experts in their own bush and felt, India, Canada, Australia, the Middle East. But what was really important about Thomas Stubbs was how he approached tactical issues in the bush. The entire British military experiment in the mid-19th century was all about seeing what was going on, marching around, bugles, red tunics, polished buttons flashing in the midday sun where they'd be strutting about. You know the saying, no one goes out in the midday sun except mad dogs and Englishmen. And you also know what they say about maxims, adages, proverbs. They express truths and pieces of wisdom. Stubbs was the diametrically opposite of the Englishman, although admittedly some did think of him as a mad dog. He had mapped most of the secondary paths used by Amaxhosa that crisscrossed British Kaffraria and showed these to Colonel Sir William Eyre. If you recall, Colonels William Eyre of the 73rd Highland Regiment And John Michel of the 6th had been savaged by the Amakosa in the thickets of Albany, sent in there by Colonel Henry Somerset, and then left to fend for themselves when the patrol went horribly wrong. They suffered the single heaviest casualty of the war, 29 British soldiers dead, 8 missing presumed dead, 41 wounded. Colonel Eyre was still nursing a battered ego when Stubbs met him, and he told Eyre there was another way to fight this war. Stubbs suggested the British reduce the size of some of their patrols and use guile, waylays and ambushes, night operations. Smaller patrols should go out dressed for lightning action, highly mobile, prepped for this night action, and wait alongside these Amakosa paths mapped by Stubbs and some of the other settlers. The warriors who walked across the territory on these paths were moving in sections and often with stolen cattle, and at night. If these well-worn trails were suddenly threatened, it could become a problem for Sandile and Makoma. It would also be a morale booster for the British. No fire, no smoking, and not a word spoken but to sit or lie with your gun in your hand from dark to daylight, Stubbs exclaimed. Eyre refused, saying it was ungentlemanly behaviour to waylay the enemy, even though the enemy's main tactic was to waylay his patrols. So he was fully aware of just how strategically important they were, and also aware of how fragile his large patrols were when strung out during the day and then ambushed by the Amakosa. Stubbs didn't give up, moving along to other British officers, but all of them rejected his idea. This idea that a non-regular member of the citizen force could dream up a military concept of any use did not sit well with the British Empire's elite corps. I've covered this in previous episodes. The frontier wars had been characterized over the century by deep dislike, where the regulars thought of the Boers and the colonials as ramshackle. The British officers were more interested in looking good, the colonists in actually getting the job done with as few casualties as possible. The arrogance shown by these imperial troops cost the empire in both lives and treasure. Worse, the lessons each frontier officer learned left South Africa with them. Then a new crop of soldiers had to relearn the rules of how to survive in Africa all over again. The Amakosa, meanwhile, had changed their mode of warfare significantly. One of the biggest changes in tactics deployed was their reliance on firearms. By the end of the 8th Frontier War, which lasted almost 2.5 years, more British troops would be killed or wounded by muskets than by assegais. The Xhosa army had another big advantage, Khoi Khoi soldiers, who'd rebelled and who were crack shots. The second major tactic change was the Khoi Khoi snipers who singled out British officers who were easy to see, gloriously fitted out in their tunics and their swords, usually sitting ramrod straight in their horses, a really good target. Plus, they were always shouting commands. Makoma and others had built up a significant arsenal between the 7th and 8th Frontier Wars, delivered by people like Stubbs's own business partners and other Grahamstown traders. Stubbs' diary was analysed in a 1965 Rhodes University master's thesis by R.T. McGough. It makes interesting reading. The description of this group changed from the Grahamstown Sporting Club in 1830 to the Grahamstown Corps of Yeomanry to Stubbs' Mounted Rangers by 1850 and then to the Albany Rangers. These rangers were very different men from the early settlers. They had hardened after they experienced numerous wars. Their attitude was very different. They had developed an independent streak. That attitude was to become a major factor in the political future of South Africa. They were paid 6 pence a day, or 6 cents in our language, but had to pay for their own horses and buy their own clothes. That wasn't sustainable, and so Stubbs rode the dangerous route from Grahamstown to King Williamstown in early 1851 to thrash things out with Governor Harry Smith. Amamtlambe Chief Siyolo had shut down this route, so the fact that Stubbs managed to make it all the way is testament to how effective he was in the bush. Smith refused to grant Stubbs' men a pay increase, but allowed the rangers to draw more food for their dependents and war material like ammunition and firearms and duffel bags and forage for their horses. So Stubbs rode back to Grahamstown, evading Siyolo's warriors once more. Stubbs had also taken a sort of a democratic leaf out of the Boers' book, as well as the Khoi Khoi, when he set up this ranger outfit. There would be a vote of all if any member was to be ejected for a lack of service or cowardice. He also instilled a form of military discipline by example, And this force became possibly one of the most effective for the British during the long Eighth Frontier War. The discipline was not about keeping everyone in a line and polishing a button, more about how they fought. It looked like a somewhat chaotic group of riders when they thundered into town, a boisterous bunch watched with some misgiving by the British regulars. Lieutenant Bell of the Cape Mounted Rifles described them in his diary. "They wear no uniform, but almost everyone seems to agree in wearing a drab wide-awake, with a band of panther skin around it. They also, without any reference to the commandant, fell out to water their horses or galloped off the road." By wide-awake he meant wide-brimmed hat. The panther skin was leopard skin. Their proactive attitude meant Grahamstonians relied on the Albany Rangers for immediate response when they required protection or support, because these men were on standby, whereas the regulars had a procedure that required strict processing. And then when on the move, the ranger patrols would not gather in a large group. They'd meet up out of town, taking off after dark. They would adopt reverse tracking to throw off anyone following them. They would not smoke, nor would they light any fires. They moved silently, binding their clasps and cloth to keep them quiet as they crept along the Amakhosa paths. Ironically, at the same time, the Amakhosa they were tracking were making quite a bit of noise, lighting fires, smoking, singing. The warriors were in command of the territory, after all. What was there for them to worry about? They knew the British were too afraid to hang around after dark, so they did not take too many precautions. I will return later to the fascinating story of the Rangers and the Amakhosa adversaries, a kind of hidden arms race buried in all the tales of South African history. But now, we have to halt for this episode. Next episode, you'll hear about the hand-to-hand fighting in Waterkloof, incredible stories of courage on both sides in the Amatola Mountains. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. That helps elevate the visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where you can sign up for my newsletter or just read about previous episodes and the other podcasts there. You can also email me and message me from the same. Until next, Salagali. Thank you.